Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
One of the great sort of aspects about, obviously, winter nights is that we get a bit concerned. I mean, I've just driven 126 miles to do this interview and have to go through the dark and all sorts of other bits and pieces. Now, to address this, who better than the awesomely talented motorist extraordinaire? She is our favourite driving correspondent across the globe. It's Vicky Butler-Henderson. How are you, Vicky?
Gosh, what an intro. Thank you very much indeed. That's lovely. I'm very well, really keeping well. Thank you.
Marvellous. Well, good to see you for a change, which is great in these wonderful radio days. But this particular survey, which suggests that actually a lot of UK drivers don't feel confident behind the wheel as, of course, the days grow shorter, the nights grow longer and so on. Having just left Lincoln this morning at 4:30, driving through the dark to get up to Teesside. I know the feeling. But what's your thoughts on this? I mean, is it a surprise? Do we need more training in this? Do we need more kind of a specialist sort of input into the whole area?
Yeah, well, this is something that I've teamed up with NFU Mutual Car Insurance to discuss and to highlight what makes us anxious at the wheel and how we can go forwards and help. And I am surprised and slightly saddened that 58% of us don't feel confident, because confidence is something that makes us better drivers and makes us happier drivers. And I love to drive. So therefore, I really want to instill in people to have confidence and to enjoy driving. And I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, certain things like road conditions and being in the dark and bad weather, they all sort of contribute to a bit of anxiety. But we can take steps to alleviate that by sort of planning better, planning our routes rather, to include roads that we're comfortable in or that are well lit, and to make sure, if you can, to drive in daylight hours and arrive in daylight hours if you can.
Well, it is interesting because obviously we've got this whole scenario whereby we're in a lockdown, supposedly, although I must admit, from the amount of traffic that was on the roads this morning, I would have said, lockdown? What's going on here? Essential journeys? I don't think so. But we are seeing a lot of challenges with that. And I think there's a lot more transport and freight transport on the roads these days, lorries and such like stuff. That, again, can create challenges in its own way, particularly when they have this sort of wonderful, and I'm sure, Vicky, it's coordinated, whereby both lorries will actually make sure they take over both lanes of the A motorway synchronously. It's amazing.
Well, lorries have like a certain speed limit. So if they're both going downhill at the same speed or both going uphill and they're stuck at their same maximum speed, that's when you get issues. So I'm sure we can all, you know, sympathize with that condition. But just planning a journey, you know, making sure that your car is road fit and you are road fit. So whether that includes going to check that you've got all your insurance cover, your breakdown cover, all your, you know, your tyres are prepped, ready for that hopeful long journey to see families come Christmas time. And also invest in yourself as well. You know, we don't have an eye test. We don't have to have an eye test from the age of 17 when we could pass our test all the way through to 70. Mm-hmm. So that is something quite shocking that we can take charge of.
Absolutely, and taking that responsibility. Unsurprisingly, 42% of drivers have anxiety after being involved in an accident or a near miss. I think it's often the case of a bit like if you fall off a horse, you've got to get back on as soon as possible, really, because the longer you leave it, the more challenging it can become. Obviously, one hopes we never have involved with accidents, etc. But, you know, essentially, it's a case of just check those things out and have confidence, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. And invest in yourself, you know, go and spend some time. If you're a little bit worried driving on slip roads, you know, coming on and off motorways, go and have some tuition on motorway driving, or go and invest in some skid car training. If you're, you know, if you live in an urban area and those roads are particularly vulnerable to icing up this winter. So just invest in yourself, use yourself as a fantastic tool, which you are. And the car around you is, you know, your conduit. And just invest in your car and in yourself, and therefore you will become a more confident driver. I guarantee it. I used to be a racing instructor at Silverstone and Brands Hatch and all various circuits around the country, and it was wonderful to be able to share my passion with other people and encourage them to brake later, you know, to use the correct gears going around the corners. So we can still learn, no matter how old we are, or how many years we've been driving, we have still got room for improvement. I still like to improve every day as well.
Exactly. And of course, we're in the decade where, who knows, we might be having electric cars, we might have self-driven cars. There are going to be lots of challenges on the roads from that point of view. It's important, obviously, to keep abreast of changes and things as and when they emerge, really.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, particularly electric cars. And they're slightly different to normal sort of petrol and diesel cars because they are incredibly quick from a standstill up to acceleration just because of the way they deliver their power all in sort of one big burst, which I love, but they might take some getting used to for, you know, certain people who've been used to driving certain cars.
This is quite clearly, Vicky, the reason you should be in charge of the Ministry of Transport. I mean, I just stand by that and I will maintain it. Vicky, where can people go to find out further details about this NFU survey and indeed the things we've been talking about today?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can get also more information on how to improve your driving skills as well. And that's nfumutual.co.uk/driving-confidence, which is what we should all be doing with.
Precisely. Vicky, presenter of Fifth Gear, presenter, of course, of The Car Years, awesome communicator. Huge thanks. The two final questions, we'll put them now in any case. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
It's been absolutely fantastic. And I have really loved seeing you. It's been great.
Well, in a sense, it's the joy of technology. So then can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you connect with us in the not too distant future?
Yes, please. Count on it.
Perfect. That's brilliant. And we'll put it out later on today. Cheers, Vicky. Take care.
All the best. You take care too. Stay safe.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Recent research has explored a fascinating world of our digital health, and indeed some of those findings have shown that over almost a quarter of the population are finding it difficult to de-stress and unwind, surprise, surprise, with a quarter admitting that working days are now longer. Indeed, one in five British men have admitted to greeting colleagues and friends online before their partner in the morning. Now, clearly something needs to be done with respect to this, so we're delighted to welcome a true dynamic duo to actually address this issue. First of all, the awesomely talented psychotherapist and extraordinary mental health specialist, and indeed author of the COVID-9 ebook, Your Mental Health First Aid Kit. It's the wonderful Zoe Aston. How are you, Zoe?
Hi there. I'm really good, thank you.
Excellent. And also to maybe sort of provide us with some interesting perspectives on the wonderful world of digital health, the UK and Ireland Consumer Category Director for Windows, it's Dave Newton. How are you, Dave?
Good morning, Rupert. Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Rupert is our wonderful engineer. Iron's Alex, but never mind. It's all good. We'll work our way through this process. It's the joy of Zoom. It's the technology. It's sorting through all aspects of sides of things. Zoe, were you astonished or surprised at all by these findings? Or did you think, well, that's the world we're living in? We're dealing with computers so often. We're working pretty much 24/7 in many ways. We don't switch off. And so that work-life balance that we used to hear so much about has gone.
Well, the data that Microsoft Windows put together was a sort of confirmation of all the things that I have been looking at throughout the pandemic. So I kind of read it through and I was like, this is true. This is absolutely what is going on right now. But because we're all in isolation, we haven't been having the conversation about it. So no one knows that other people are experiencing the same kind of difficulties with their digital habits. So when this project came about, I was very excited about being able to give people the tools and resources to kind of empower their own habits, their plans, their ability to use their technology to help them be more productive and be more healthy.
Dave, from the point of view of obviously technology, if the pandemic had occurred 10, 20 years ago, there's no way we would have actually been able to have transferred so much material online as we have. And although people might well be triggered into all sorts of paroxysms of annoyance when I start talking about Microsoft Teams, Blackboard Collaborate, Zoom, all of the many ways in which we use that, the fact of the matter is that without you guys at Microsoft and indeed technical workers and digital technologies, we would have basically been even more isolated, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the world has been, the UK in particular, has been forced into a new reality where technology has really helped us to continue some of the normal things we expect from our lives, such as work, family engagements, and social lives. And you know, we see that the role of digital health really is a crucial part of everybody's well-being, alongside diet, exercise, sleep, and relationships. And some of the tools that we've got embedded within our Windows PCs are there. And the research tells us that people, they know they need to improve their digital health. They think there's tools out there. They just don't know where to find them, which is why we're really excited to start the conversation today around digital health.
Zoe, the traditional notion of if you're working on a computer screen, you should use the 20-20 rule and effectively turn away every 20 minutes or so on and so forth. Has that kind of gone by the wayside in terms of the current experience, where with respect to, obviously, as I mentioned, some of those wonderful tools we're using one today, basically, to connect together digitally, that sometimes we forget that, you know, maybe the way in which we as human beings are interfacing with the computer screen is perhaps not fundamentally, but different from our usual face-to-face interactions?
Yeah, I would say lots of the historic hints and tips and stuff that we've been given to help us work with our screens is now different. And I would say it has fundamentally changed. We are now using our computers to do everything, to connect with people, to do our emails, to do our work tasks, to relax. We are using them as they are across our lives. We use them in everything to do with our lives at the moment. During the lockdown, people like to exercise on them, all sorts of things. So the idea that you're going to look away from it every 20 minutes is something that, yes, I think has fallen by the wayside, as has the idea of having the sort of work-life boundaries, as if you can kind of be online at work and then not then being in your personal life. And part of what we're doing is trying to give people the external and internal tools to be able to set those boundaries within their digital life, within their approach to well-being across the board. Because there's no doubt that things have changed, probably for the better, because if we didn't have technology the way that we have got it at the moment, a bit like your previous question, this year, you know, much more would have fallen by the wayside, much more would have been impossible. So really teaching people to readjust what they know about using their screens, using their digital habits into more sustainable and moderate boundaries, changes, sort of hit, I'm trying to look for a word, yeah. Helping people find more balance within their relationship with their screens is what we're aiming for.
Yeah, absolutely. Balance, I think, the key thing. Now, I mean, Zoe, you obviously, in your professional life, you offer a range of emotional and psychological topics. You deal with addiction, you deal with eating disorders, trauma, anxiety, relationship issues, and so on. Does this encompass all of those? Is it a case of, you know, your digital health can actually be fundamental to actually the way in which we relate to other creatures on the planet?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the tips that we are talking about throughout this campaign is connection and the importance of using your tech to connect with people in different ways. So, for example, if you're at home on your own, if you're in lockdown isolating on your own, then it's important that, you know, you don't just sit down and have formal conversations with people using Teams or Skype, that maybe you have someone on your screen, on your Skype, on your Teams while you're cooking dinner, making sure that you know, you're not getting too lonely, using tech to help soothe that feeling of being isolated. And we have had to learn to connect with people throughout this year. Historically, connection, we've always kind of put it on the idea of being with people in person and being able to be with another body, and this year it just hasn't been possible, so we have almost been forced to work harder at our connections. And lots of people, I know part of the research showed that people have actually deepened their connections with family members and old friends that they've lost contact with, and I include myself in that as well. You know, there have been times during this year where I've reached out to people I haven't spoken to for ages, for no particular reason other than it didn't really kind of pop into my mind. But with everything that's going on and with the use of technology, it was almost like, actually, that's totally possible to try and reconnect with that person. So, yeah, I mean, and you mentioned some of those things at the beginning that I work with. For people in recovery from any kind of mental health issue, problem, without technology this year, it would have been absolutely disastrous. I've been working purely virtually with my clients, and all of the support groups and everything went online. If we didn't have access to that, the mental health pandemic that we might see later down the line would have been much more heightened.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Dave, returning back to your good self, there are five wonderful tips that have actually been produced in terms of suggestions forward, which has always obviously been key in terms of coordinating. The first of which is make technology work for you. Is that one of the things that you think is the most important one, or would you say, no, I prefer to set digital boundaries and unlock the imagination?
I think for me personally, it is how you make it work for you. To give you a real example of that, within Windows, we have a tool called Focus Assist. Now, it sounds quite simple, quite straightforward, but actually the way I use this, I have so many, we have so many notifications throughout our day, whether it is our phones, whether it is our PCs. Focus Assist allows me to basically say which ones of these I do or don't want to receive throughout my day. So I can make sure that my working day is my working day, and my family time is family time, and we try not to blur those lines. The research tells us that people are feeling like those lines are blurred, they're working longer. So actually make technology work for you in keeping those boundaries would be our advice, one of our parts of our advice and tips.
Well, I must admit, I do find that Google Analytics and the sort of breakdown of useful time, etc., are quite irritating. In addition to that, even when I actually sort of respond to the Cortina request, has this been useful to you, with a thumbs down, I still get notifications. But what the hey, it's just my sort of relationship with the digital interface on that system. Let's go back to Zoe. I suspect, Zoe, that some of the other aspects that are in this top five, in addition to making technology work for us, setting yourself digital boundaries, noticing our patterns of behavior, moving, actually being kinetic and actually moving our body and unlocking our imagination, they're all areas that you would say are essential.
Absolutely. And the reason I chose those is because they cover the mental and physical aspect as well. We can't think about our digital lives as something that's separate from our mental health and our physical health anymore. It is absolutely integrated, and we're going to have to open up the conversation to mental health, physical health, and digital health, because not only can they support each other, but when one's going well, the other one benefits. So things like moving your body is part of being productive when you are in your digital sphere. For example, I find that if I'm having a bit of a tricky time, I can't quite get my mindfulness in the space where I want it to be, I can't quite find my focus, walking around the block or doing something that actually allows my system, my whole system, my nervous system to reset, often gives me the opportunity to process what's going on. And then I usually know the answer. It's just that I've got a little bit confused about something. So physically moving our bodies and accessing our energies is just as important a part of our digital lives as sitting in front of our emails or sitting in front of our screens. And things like boundaries, people think about those in terms of relationships and, you know, putting in blocks to stop bad things happening. But actually boundaries really create good in our relationships, our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with other people, and our relationship in the things that we use, like our digital habits. So knowing where your boundaries are, where your limitations are, and also what your potential is what that's all about. Well, so I would say these are things that cover all three aspects of health. Yeah,
absolutely. No, I was just going to say, I could see a whole online web series of digital doodling with Dave, just for the alliteration alone would be fantastic. Dave, where would you actually point people in terms of finding out more details about this particular fantastic digital health aspect?
Well, there's a couple of places that your listeners can go to. The first would be windows.com, and there's loads of tips and tools and features on there they can use to really help them understand how to get the most from their technology. And the second one, of course, is the amazing Zoe's Instagram page, which is instagram.com/your mental health workout, where you can access some of the tips we spoke about, but also there's content on there so you can start to look inward at yourself, kind of how am I going to change going forward, that Zoe's pulled together. So they would be the two main places.
Fantastic. I was also going to mention Zoe Aston.com, which of course is an awesome website in which you can actually see your mental health first aid kit and all sorts of other aspects coming through from that. We wrap up with two final questions. We call them kind of digital customer satisfaction in many ways. So first of all, to yourself, Dave, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Do we get a smiley face?
You absolutely do. Big thumbs up and a smiley face. Yeah.
Okay. And Zoe, same question to yourself. Has it been okay for you?
Of course, absolutely. Pleasure talking to you.
Splendid. Then hopefully we look forward to featuring you both again in the artist's future. Dave Newton and Zoe Aston, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and keep those digital boundaries going.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Air pollution. We would have thought we might have actually sort of sorted that out after the smog-based London of the 50s, 60s and so on, and indeed lots of other things. But it seems that when it comes to air pollution awareness, we're still actually in the dark. So accordingly, we're bringing in the legendary superheroes of meteorology and indeed sport, two fabulous individuals to actually join us today. First of all, Victoria Pendleton, CBE, Olympic world champion, European champion, I mean, and switching sports as well. Victoria, you are a legend in the true sense of the word. How are you, Victoria?
I'm good, thank you. It's very kind of you.
Excellent. And equally legendary from the point of view of meteorology, of course, it's the awesomely talented Claire Nazir. How are you, Claire?
Hi, Alex. Really good, actually. Thank you.
Good. Now, share with us, Claire, this particular finding that actually, you know, in terms of our awareness of air pollution, it's not as good as it might be. And there's lots of room for improvement, really, particularly as we're undergoing lockdown and all sorts of things.
Yes, there is a room for improvement, because actually, I don't think the information is out there on a daily basis, so we know what's happening in our air. Our air pollution levels go from low, which means it's good quality air, fresh air, to poor quality or high levels of air pollution on a daily basis, particularly during rush hour or on a broader scale when the weather is calm or whether it's unsettled. And so this survey, which we're talking about today, E.ON asked 4,000 people about air pollution, and 86% of them believe that air pollution is something that we should know more about. So that speaks volumes in itself. And that's why I'm helping E.ON with this new initiative. It's called Change the Weather Service, where we make air quality information available to the media so they can include it in their weather forecasts. And so we're all better informed.
Victoria, whether you're on horseback or indeed on a bike, clearly getting that fuel to actually pedal or indeed control is absolutely vital. Just share with us your own concerns about this invisible threat.
Well, it's something that affects everybody, whether you're a training athlete or whether you're just taking a walk on your daily commute to work, for example. It's something that can affect all of us. And if you have respiratory conditions, then obviously it's something that we need to take into consideration. And I think, you know, the survey showed that 83% of people would be more inclined to take action if they had more information. So providing it in the weather service might make someone decide whether they're going to go out for a run today or whether it's a good day to train or a day that they maybe should just have a rest day and try again tomorrow when the weather changes. So it's kind of, it's giving people the ability to make their own informed decision based on accurate information. And for me, I think that's something that can only be a benefit to making those decisions.
Sure. Claire, I know for many people, they maintain that if anybody can control the weather, it's yourself, Claire, but maybe not. You can predict it, but not control it. But is that something where via technology, we can, as Victoria said there, get to the notion of actually getting that sort of sense of, well, should we go out? Should we actually go out on our own risk, etc.? Or do we need to actually think again?
Well, that's exactly what the weather forecast is there for. And during the summer and spring months, it's pollen count. During the winter months, it might be just the risk of ice. So air pollution should be part of that. It's an environmental hazard which actually impacts health. And it doesn't happen every day. We live on an island. Our weather mostly comes in from the west. It's fresh air. But when the air is quiet, that's when those toxic fumes can build up in the lower atmosphere. And that's why it's so important to have that information to hand, so it's accessible and it's part of our daily language, like say the pollen count. So it's not only people who perhaps do suffer with breathing issues, but it's everybody just wants to step outside and enjoy the environment outside. And that's, and the one of the other reasons which I think this is, it's so timely, is because during the first lockdown the air was so much cleaner. In fact, nitrogen dioxide levels were 60% lower. That's incredible. We haven't seen levels like that for decades. So we've never really experienced in our lifetime clean air in towns and cities. And because we experience that, we want to experience it again. And that was part of the survey. 62% of people said, yes, we would like to see that clean air again, despite all the uncertainty around lockdown. And that's why this survey has come at a good time where we can make proactive moves so everybody can be part, not only of the conversation, but actually make informed choices.
Victoria, the difference, of course, with the current lockdown is that there are many of us, and I include myself here, who are working in education, who effectively we still have to travel. We're key workers. We have to work through that process. Do you feel as though we're looking nostalgically back at that, those 4 to 5 weeks, et cetera, in March and April and so on, where we thought, gosh, you know, we need to return to this? And it does have a clear message about the amount of pollution that's out there in any case.
It does have a clear message. It's in terms of trying to maybe look at what we can do that it's kind of workable with the scenario we're in now, but also in the future when hopefully things go back to normality in some ways. And, you know, there's lots of things we can do that would benefit not just our the pollution levels, but if we choose to take shorter journeys by foot or by bike, for example, then there's going to be physical benefits. There's going to be mental health benefits of being outdoors and the environmental benefits of reducing air pollution. But not only that, supporting local amenities, shops and services is always great for our economy as well. And supporting the ones that might be struggling. So making tiny changes and supporting local, for example, and conserving energy at home are things we can all do, regardless of whether we're in lockdown or out of lockdown. And this will hopefully have a long-term effect on our air quality, and future generations hopefully will understand and act more accordingly to help and support one another.
And Claire, clearly you'd echo those kind of aspects. Do you feel as though the prognosis is good, that as we actually look ahead, that, you know, people are aware of this and also that changes are being put in place? I mean, with the upcoming launch of more electric cars, etc., will that also help improve air quality?
I mean, I think it's a great initiative, but we're talking 10, 20, 30 years down the line. And that's another generation of kids who are growing up in dirty air. And in fact, it does impact even lung capacity at a very, very early age. So it's something we have to act on now. Yes, there are steps, there's moves to low emission zones, etc., but there's still a lot of traffic on the roads. And despite a second lockdown, there's more traffic than it was on the first lockdown. And things will get back to normal, and we hope they will. So there are things that we can do. And in fact, this survey was fascinating because, in fact, people want to take action. People want to be more informed. And that means we have a responsibility as broadcasters to impart that information in the clearest, simplest, and effective way possible. And that's why this E.ON campaign is so important for people like myself, because it enables me to, in a very short space of time, tell people whether the air is good or bad in a day.
Precisely. Victoria, where would you point people on the World Wide Web to actually go to find out further information about what we've been talking about today?
Well, you can just search E.ON Clean Air in any search engine and you'll find all the information you need.
Excellent. Well, the campaign, I think, already starts here to ensure that we move your level, Victoria, up from CBE to Dame Victoria Pendleton. I think that needs to actually start campaigning there. And likewise, Claire Nazir, because you actually win the award for the most interesting background we've had on a Zoom call for quite some time, which is astonishing. I mean, you've got your weather forecast in the background. You've got also, I mean, it's radio, but it's still wonderful that you've got your sort of tornado that's there, curious nimbus clouds, etc. Claire,
right.
I think you definitely deserve at least CB and probably a day for yourself in the long term. So we'll work on that. For the moment, Victoria Pendleton and Claire Nazir, huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thank you,
Alex.
One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Well, it's National Anti-Bullying Week, and rather sadly, 38% of children in the 9 to 18-year-old brackets don't think the government is doing enough to keep people safe online. 44% of children have actually been bullied online, and they've said this has happened in the last 6 months. Now, to actually talk us through this and maybe address some of the ways in which we can ensure that safety is paramount when going online, we're delighted to welcome safeguarding expert, the wonderful Charlotte Ainsley. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is very I say sad in terms of the actual news thing. It's disturbing because clearly this sort of aspect of human nature that sort of leads to bullying, it's not good. And I mean, when we actually add to that 16% of 10-year-old children have actually had suicidal thoughts because of online bullying and harassment, clearly something needs to be addressed as far as this is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, really sad statistics and sad that we are still talking about this 20 years on. I mean, I've been involved in the kind of online safeguarding space for 20 years and we're still talking about the numbers of children, young people suffering bullying online. And as you quite rightly point out, the research commissioned by Impero Software found that 22% of children and young people were being bullied. And of that 22%, 44% of them had experienced bullying in the last 6 months. And we all know that children and young people are spending far more time online, certainly during lockdown, than they had done previously because they're playing games, they're accessing learning, they're going on social media, they're watching YouTube. So it's really sad that we have to still find ourselves in this situation where the statistics are quite high.
Yeah, also the kind of content that they're seeing. I mean, 30% have admitted to seeing cruelty to animals, nearly, again, 39% violence and distressing content, hate sites, terror attacks, beheadings and bombings. I mean, this is something which you wouldn't expect most adult people to actually have to cope with. But actually, if you're using that in terms of people as young as 10 seeing disorder content, strategies and so on and so forth, it does seem as though we've got a wild west of online frontier work there that needs to be, and I don't like the term policed, but maybe there needs to be at least safeguards and sort of systems put in place that actually prevents children from actually accessing this material.
Absolutely. And the online harms bill that the government put into place, or the white paper that they put into place last year, the process should have been started this year. It hasn't been started due to delays due to COVID-19. And that means that it's going to be next year and probably 2023 before the bill is enacted completely. And that involves a duty of care for social media companies and the tech giants so that they are more accountable and transparent for the content that is shared on those platforms, which will mean it's an easier job for parents to help to support their children and to help to make informed decisions about the sorts of sites and services that their children should be using.
And that's pretty critical to the whole side of things, because just as we wouldn't necessarily want children to be accessing certain films, certain movies, certain content from that point of view, the reason we actually have a classification system is because, you know, exactly that. You don't want children to actually be exposed to material which is outside their age bracket. Surely it can't be beyond the wit of technological providers to actually at least have guidance systems put into place in there. And indeed, as a lot of companies have actually started actually ensuring that, you know, there are parental locks in terms of what is actually available and accessible for children.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are things in place. We're not entirely remiss of any safeguards at all. And you will know if your children play games that there are age ratings on games, and there's something called the PEGI system, which helps parents to identify what sort of content features in games, whether it's violent content, sexual content. So they, again, helps them to make an informed decision about what their children are using. Of course, in the offline world, we use all of the sort of social cues around us to gauge how we should behave and to understand how we behave. In the online world, that doesn't exist in quite the same way. So it can be that children find themselves in a kind of shady area of the internet purely by accident, and then they might see some content which is inappropriate or upsetting to them. And often, sometimes, especially younger children, they feel like it's their fault. So it's crucial that parents and carers talk to their children about what they see online, and that they should always come to them if they are worried about something that they've seen, or if indeed they are being bullied.
One of the things that I always find quite annoying, perhaps, or irritating, or just actually disappointing about the web is you can guarantee that for every news story that actually goes out, or any features actually there, if there's a chance for people to actually put comments in, whether it's YouTube videos, whether it's other sort of aspects, there's an awful lot of vitriol that tends to be poured out with respect to that. So bearing that in mind, why do you think there's been an increase in bullying in the last 6 months? Because clearly, there are human beings that we share the planet with that for whatever reason feel that it's perfectly okay to actually sort of put all sorts of negative thoughts in terms of their messages and so on, whereas actually they wouldn't dare of doing that in real life.
Yeah, and it's sad, isn't it, that given our current situation and our circumstances, this is essentially the last thing that any child and young person needs, to be bullied in the online environment. But one of the things that we talk about in the online environment is online disinhibition, and it can almost kind of trick people into being somebody or behaving in a way that they're actually not. So it's really important that we talk to children and young people about being kind to each other in the online space, and kind of build those messages up, both from a kind of parental perspective, but also a school perspective as well. It's important that we have those conversations and we talk to children and young people about the impact of bullying and how it can make people feel.
We've talked about the Online Harms Bill, of course. Could you share some thoughts with us about the Hybrid Learning Support Grant that's actually being launched this week as well?
Yes, so Impero Software specialise in safeguarding software for schools. And as we're all in this kind of new brave world where children are learning both online at home, but also in school as well, Impero have launched a £1 million scheme for schools to be able to access the safeguarding software, so that if students do have to go home and learn at home because of COVID-19, they can access that software so that we can help to protect them in both environments.
Certainly, we can only hope that the better part of human nature will out in terms of that side of things. Charlotte, are you optimistic in terms of, about the future? Do you think that things will get better, or is it a case of, human beings tend to indulge in this no matter what we sort of set up for them?
I think we're better at teaching and learning about this issue. I think where we are lagging behind is making the social media companies more accountable for the content that's shared on their platform. So I'm kind of split. I'm 50-50. I'm always optimistic, so I'm going to try and remain that way. Yeah.
Okay, well, for the moment, Charlotte Ains, the online advisor, or indeed online safety advisor, many thanks indeed. Where would you point people to go to if they wanted to find out more details about either the grant or indeed some of the other things we've spoken about today, Charlotte?
If you want to find out more, please go to imperosoftware.com.
Charlotte Ainsley, huge thanks. Stay safe.
Thank you.
Oh, what is this world so full of care? We have no time to stand and stare. Words that still resonate even in the 21st century. And it would seem that a number of folk are still actually not benefiting from taking those moments to actually engage with the planet and so on. Even though, as we look at the latest figures, in the first week of lockdown, a tenth of the population didn't go outside at all. Now, I appreciate that there are many folk who are actually working in education, higher education and indeed schools, who might well be saying, lockdown? What lockdown? But at the same time, it is still important to connect with nature during this particular period for us. Psychological well-being, if nothing else, and to talk us through some of the amazing tips that they've come up with to actually sort of ensure that we can have a new look at the wonders that the planet actually has just in our very own locality. We're delighted to welcome from Friends of the Earth the wonderful Guy Shrubsole. How are you, Guy?
Very good, thanks very much, Alex. Yeah, good morning to you.
Excellent. So as I mentioned, I mean, clearly there are a number of people who aren't leaving their home at all for this whole sort of system. Others who have no option but to leave their home because of obviously work commitments and key workers and so on and so forth. But tell us about, in essence, the 15 top tips. So I get 15 top tips that you've actually come up with in terms of how we could all start reconnecting with nature.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, Friends of the Earth did this survey which has shown that half of the public in Britain didn't get out into any kind of green or open space during the entire first week of this current lockdown. And so in terms of motivation, people often seem to be lacking motivation and lacking inspiration. We found that a fifth of respondents simply said they lacked inspiration as to what to do outdoors. and cited that as a reason for not getting outdoors more. So we decided that we'd put out a list of hints and tips for things people can do to reconnect with nature, everything from just, you know, simply trying to identify bird species that are currently migrating for winter, listening out for owls calling out at night if you're in a part of the country where you might have owls nesting in trees nearby, watching an autumn sunrise. I was lucky enough to get out this morning just to see the sunrise. I live near a river, and just to see the sun reflected on the glinting, rippling river was just fantastic. And in the clouds, it just looked amazing as well. You know, we obviously get a lot of clouds in the UK, particularly at this time of year. But, you know, maybe trying to do a bit of cloud identification as well, you know, learning your cirrus from your cumulonimbus, for example. But something I've also been particularly keen to do at this time of year, because it's just such a fantastic nose you get on field maples, the brilliant bronzes of beech trees and oak trees as their leaves turn for the winter. For fungi,
One of the things, of course, that you've just alluded to there is the personal experience of actually connecting from this point of view. It's not the same if you're simply using a streaming service to watch a nature documentary, is it?
No, it's not. And whilst, you know, nature documentaries and the great David Attenborough and so on can inspire us to get, you know, to enjoy nature, I think we really do need to be getting out in it more, not just experiencing it behind a screen. And, you know, the sights and sounds and things that you see outside and will, you know, come to observe, I think, are just, there's so much more out there than we often think. So, you know, just this morning, we've got a tiny garden where I live, looked outdoors and found a little tiny butterfly chrysalis, and just wrapped up in some silk, kind of wrapped around a leaf, and just things like that that you won't get from just sort of watching another nature documentary about, you know, tigers in India or whatever. Brilliant as they are, there's also nature right under our nose, and we need to get out more and experience it and enjoy it.
Now, you've talked about obviously using our senses to appreciate an autumn sunset, sunrise, and so on, to actually connect from that point of view, but also looking for signs of insects becoming dormant for winter, like butterfly chrysalises. That's quite an interesting one. Obviously, don't disturb them, that's the important thing. And also, the one that I was quite fascinated by, which is looking for faces in trees.
Yes, absolutely. A bit of a pastime of mine. And, you know, if you've got some nice ancient trees near you, or the gnarly bark, often it just, you know, contains lots of hidden faces forming things, trees for seeming to form expressions. I also think that it's really good to be kind of getting outdoors to do things like scavenger hunts. You know, if you can do that with your family, with your kids, trying to look for things like fallen leaves and twigs and rubbings from tree bark rubbings, and then, you know, sharing those results with your family, or over Zoom if you're distant from the other family members.
And much as I'm sure that many people would like to listen for owls calling out at night, for many urban dwellers, that's probably not necessarily an option. In that particular case, would you suggest that maybe actually looking for, not the sounds of the city, but maybe actually exploring some of those paths that maybe haven't been explored before, or, I mean, possibly arranging a scavenger hunt would be useful?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the thing, is that, you know, nature is really everywhere, and even if we tend to overlook it, you know, it's everything from what we think of as being the weeds that grow through the cracks in pavements, but actually are often wild plants and wild flowers that, you know, I was excited to see during the first lockdown, a group of rebel botanists, as they call themselves, springing up on Twitter and trying to help people identify those plants by chalking the names of them onto the pavements. So it's things like that. It's looking out for things, nature all around us. As you say, heading down a local path that you might have overlooked until recently, just allowing curiosity to take your fancy and really get out and explore more, because, you know, it's all around us. Nature is, I think, rightly sometimes called by authors and scientists the natural health service. It's there to help us, prevent us from getting ill in many ways, because access to nature can often boost our immune system, make us calmer, and just lift our spirits, really. And obviously we need that at a time when often the news is depressing. We obviously are feeling the strains of lockdown and coronavirus. And I think we just need to use nature to give us a bit of a lift up, a bit of a tonic, really, for our spirits.
and maybe acknowledging the fact that coronavirus in its own way is also maybe nature pressing the reset button. So you do actually have time to actually not necessarily keep going crazy, running around like the proverbial headless chickens and so on. I mean, there is a thing called the COVID dividend, where actually the things we have experienced during lockdown, maybe in many cases, we need to take the lessons that we've learned and actually ensure that that's also part of the whole thing that we're sort of faced with as when we come out of the lockdown as well.
Exactly, and you know, as we try and do things like building back greener from coronavirus and from lockdown, you know, being able to have more access to green space, I think that's something that lockdown has really, really shown starkly. You know, 1 in 8 Britons doesn't have a garden, and there's great inequalities in access to green space. So that's something that Friends of the Earth is also campaigning for, is the government to invest more in creating things like new parks, pocket parks, and really allowing people to really get outside more, because, you know, that's something I think that lockdown has shown very clearly. We really need access to nature, and often there's not enough of it on our doorsteps in certain parts of the country. So, yeah.
Of the range of things and tips we've actually discussed today, do you have a particular favourite guy? Are you a sort of key listener to owls? Is it the tree faces, etc.? Is the one that kind of stands out as, this is my own personal favourite?
I think, to be honest, at this time of year, it has to be about trees, really, for me. I just love looking at their amazing leaves, the autumnal leaves that they, you know, they bless us with. And I think all of the, you know, wonderful colours that you can pick out in beeches and in oak trees, in chestnuts and so on. So I really encourage people to get out and look for your favourite autumnal leaves and do a bit more, go a bit further, try and identify the tree species. Maybe even trying to have a guess at the age of the tree, you know, by looking at the width of the trunk and how long it might have been growing there for, because it's really a bit of history as well. It's nature showing us, you know, some of its most ancient and biggest species there in trees.
Absolutely. Certainly, Tolkien knew what he was doing when he actually created the species of Ents and so on, exactly. And tree beard and so on. Where can people go to, Guy, to find out more details about some of the things we've talked about today, vis-a-vis Friends of the Earth and those lists of things that people can do to reconnect with nature? Where would you point them?
Yes, well, if you want to visit our website, friendsoftheearth.uk/nature, you can find our hints and tips there and also find out more about the campaigning we're doing to protect and restore nature.
Guy Shrubsole, campaigner at Friends of the Earth, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on, Guy.
Thanks very much, Alex, and you.
Well, we know that key workers are an absolutely essential part of the challenges that we've been faced with in 2020. And clearly, we've talked about the fabulous work that's being done within the NHS. But what about the shop workers? And we know many of our folk have actually been connected with this. We all actually would be hopelessly lost without shop workers working through that. And yet, despite claiming to respect shop workers, 1 in 5 adults in the UK have admitted to mistreating them. Completely unacceptable. And indeed, to find out some of the backdrop to this shocking statistic, we're delighted to welcome the Campaigns and Public Affairs Director for Co-op Shop Workers, Paul Gerard. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of other folk and many of our listeners will be equally as stunned by this particular line, that actually, you know, we've got threatening behaviour in the case of 12%. Actually, 7% have actually witnessed an incident of assault. More than a quarter of us have been present while a shopkeeper was being verbally abused. I mean, this is wrong on a human basis, let alone shop workers stuff. I mean, what's going on? Is it just humanity living down to its worst instincts?
So, shop worker violence and abuse has been on the rise for a number of years. In 2019, the British Retail Consortium estimated that 400 shop workers across the UK are being attacked every single day. So this was an issue before COVID. But what we have seen during COVID, and the co-op has seen this, but any of your listeners who are working retail or family working retail will recognise this, we've seen an increase during COVID. In the co-op, we've seen a 136% increase in violence and abuse towards our colleagues during COVID. And what that actually means, Alex, what that actually means is that we have colleagues being attacked every day. We have 10 colleagues being attacked physically in store every day. There'll be 4 of them will be attacked with weapons. They'll be attacked with syringes. They'll be attacked with knives. They'll be attacked with a medieval mace on occasion. They are left with serious physical and emotional damage that they will have to live with for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I mean, I think it's fair to say that you don't necessarily go into retail to expect to actually have danger money to actually deal with, you know, insane members of the public. And, you know, what you've actually said clearly demonstrates that, that there's a major problem from this point of view. What are the reasons that are actually given? I mean, is it just a case of people having a bad day, that maybe, you know, they've kind of got irritated, that maybe there's been a trigger word that started off like, you know, can I help you, sir or madam? You know, what kind of things are actually used to kind of trigger off these acts of violence?
So before COVID, the two main reasons were people were challenged to do shoplifting or they were challenged for age-restricted sales like alcohol or cigarettes. They're the two reasons for abuse and violence. What we've seen during COVID is that actually, according to Usdaw, the union who run Respect for Shop Workers Week, the top five reasons are now all to do with the enforcement of the restrictions that we're all living under. It could be early on in the pandemic, it was restrictions on what you could buy, or it's queuing, or it's social distancing in stores, or it's the wearing of face masks. That's what is triggering abuse and violence now. And I think what's happening is that people are getting frustrated, absolutely, and I think they are lashing out. I think what really struck me about the research that we published today is that, as you said, 90% think shop workers are essential workers, but one in five of us have attacked or abused shop workers. The one thing I would pull out, you know, is that half of us who see something happening intervene. Now, I don't want customers or indeed my colleagues to put themselves in harm's way, but the fact that half of the people who see something happening step in to help the shop worker, I think tells you underlying this what most people think about shop workers. They recognise the value and the essential service they provided as they stepped up during the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any kind of differences regionally, Paul, in terms of where folk are more likely to be kind of impacted on this? I mean, I do hope that around Lincoln everything's all okay, likewise in the Northeast, etc. But I mean, is there a particular area that's worse than others?
So, I mean, we've got 25 stores in Lincolnshire, and obviously there's also the Lincolnshire Co-op as well. There is some regional difference, but in truth, this is a problem right across the country. And I think right across the core country, before COVID, violence and abuse was on the rise. And during COVID, it's got even worse. And I think it is people getting frustrated, people getting frayed. But that's not an excuse to take it out on shop workers. I would ask them just to take a breath, have a word with themselves, and recognise that the person that they're looking at is someone's mother or father or wife or husband or daughter or son, and that they're to help them and that they're trying to help them. So don't take out frustrations of COVID on those hardworking people.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in terms of obviously addressing it on a personal level, you mentioned, as say, that the notion to that if feasible, and of course, if do you know, again, don't just stand by idly and actually watch somebody being abused. That's just, you know, not acceptable from that point of view. But I see that there's also a petition that the British Retail Consortium Crime Survey has also put together, where people might be interested actually in signing that. Would you like to just share details about that with us as well, Paul?
Yeah, so the petition is actually from Usdaw, the union. And what it is it's asking for government to take action to protect shop workers more. What's interesting, actually, Alex, is that hopefully before Christmas, if you are a shop worker in Scotland, you will have greater protection under the law in Scotland than a shop worker in Lincolnshire. Because in Scotland, Daniel Johnson MSP's bill is being passed, and that bill will provide greater protection for shop workers in Scotland. A similar bill, actually, is in the House of Commons as we speak from Alex Noyce MP from Nottinghamshire North. We could really do with government backing that. And what Usdaw's petition does is ask for people to back it, ask for people to sign the petition. Because if that petition gets 100,000 signatures, and it's got about 75,000 now, there will be a debate in Parliament about that issue. So I would ask people that, aside from taking personal responsibility in stores and not to abuse or attack shop workers, they do not deserve abuse, they deserve thanks. Also, go out, go on the internet, Usdaw's petition, sign it, and help us get greater protection for the people who've stepped up throughout this pandemic to make sure we can all be fed the real food heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the address to go to, presumably, petition.parliament.uk/petitions. And then it's number 328621. That's 328621, which at least people can actually go through. I mean, I just sort of, in closing, Paul, put the notion to you that, well, people say, well, why don't they just actually replace all the shop workers with respect to automated tills and other bits and pieces? Well, actually, mental health doesn't necessarily really relate well when we don't have any human beings to connect to. So I do think it's worth acknowledging, as you've just said, that not only are key workers and shop workers providing a vital part of the whole system. Maybe we need each other as human beings as well.
Absolutely right. What we saw over many years now is that very often my colleagues in the Coke stores up and down the country, like the 40 in Lincolnshire, or often the people who are a lifeline to that community, were more than just a shop in many communities, were part of that community and provided a lifeline. As we've seen through COVID, when my colleagues have delivered tens of thousands of packages to the vulnerable and the isolated. Shop workers are more than just selling beans.
Yeah, precisely. And Paul, just finally, where would you point people if they want to find out more details about what we've been talking about today? Would it be that petitions thing, or is there another website that you'd like to mention?
If you really want to find out about the kind of issues that shop workers face, I would suggest you go to co-op.uk, co-op.co.uk, the co-op's website, and type in crime campaign. And there's a load of information there and academic research about what is happening and what needs to be done. So if you Google co-op crime campaign.
Paul Gerard, Campaigns and Public Affairs Director. Actually, Paul, I do have to ask the question. Are you related at all to Stephen Gerrard, the former Liverpool footballer and Glasgow Rangers manager?
I am not. I am a red, but I'm a different kind of red to the
one. It's just as well I don't start sharing my Manchester City connections with you, otherwise we could go on for all sorts of things. whatever. Paul Gerrard, Campaigns and Public Affairs Director for the Co-op. Many thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on.
Thanks, Alex.